In a world where film reviews are currency.
Please, I gave your movie 4 stars. I just need to feed my family.
One person is changing the landscape of criticism forever.
It's you. You're the one they're calling the great film review detective.
But she's not just any investigator taking film critics to task.
No, you're thinking about my second cousin, twice removed.
But then, who are you?
You can call me Christopher Nolan.
But Christopher's a boy's name.
First mystery of the day, what movie taught you toxic masculinity?
This summer.
Come on, Wilston, we have another case to solve.
Two detectives are on the film take.
Detective E. Nolan, why are you sneaking around this abandoned public school?
Elementary, my dear Wilston.
I'm pretty sure this is grade 6 or 8.
And they're not ready for their biggest challenge yet.
Egad, Wilston! The 1-star review slasher was just here at this drive-in, blasting their headlights at the screen and complaining about the movies being tonally jarring.
Who would do such a heinous thing?
No, it can't be. You're...
Is it Christopher Nolan?
Finally, my destiny has come to this.
Will they survive to get a sequel? Or will they flop?
Detective E. Nolan, this anonymous film critic in Los Angeles is complaining about getting free movie screeners and calling Stanley Kubrick overrated. What do we do?
Hand me my letterboxed account, Wilston. We're going to find out how many stars this monster gave Green Book.
Oh no, it's so many. Who is even capable of these takes?
Using first person in the review, dirt underneath the fingernails, spacebar is broken, avatar is a picture of Garfield the cat but with muscles. Wait, Wilston, is this you?
How did you figure all that out in just your head? Oh, I'm so ashamed.
Wilston, you're being hysterical.
Oh, sorry, narrator guy.
Sherlock Holmes. Coming whenever movie theaters reopen for real and the studios know for sure they'll make a profit. Welcome once again to Cinemaholics from the San Francisco Bay Area, which is smoky and the air is not ideal. I am John Negroni, box office columnist for Adam Tickets and editor-in-chief of Cinemaholics. And look, from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, he is a pop culture writer for Cinema Blend. He also reviews films for Cinemaholics.com. It's Will Ashton.
Hello.
From Kansas City, she is the film editor for The Pitch. And her bylines, there's too many to count. I'll say two of them, slash film and crooked marquee. It's Abiel Chessy.
Hello.
You can find more episodes of Cinemaholics, including our full archive, on cinemaholics.com, including written reviews. And you can always send us a fun, polite, professional email, whatever you want, cinemaholicspodcast@gmail.com. Now, we tell you every week, yeah, we got a Patreon. It's fun. We love our Patreon. We love our patrons. And we have a new thing on the Patreon this week. You guessed right. I can hear you. Merchandise. Cinemaholics merch is official.
Merch.
Yeah, I'm going to talk more about it in off topics. I don't want to drag this out, but we're going to tell you what the merch deal is about, because it's a little bit more complicated than at first glance. Complicated in a good way. So I'll just say that. But okay. First off topic of the week, Extra Milestone. Again, Sam Noland, our host of Extra Milestone, which is a podcast on this feed. The two films for the film anniversaries this year, they're both from 1985. They could not be more different. Come and See and then Back to the Future. So I don't know what the deal is with this. I did listen to the episode and I am still flabbergasted in a good way. And that episode is out right now. And it did make me actually want to watch Come and See, even though I know that it's probably going to put me in a very terrible mood. But also, Sam Nolan and Adonis Gonzalez are as busy as ever. Not only did they do that Extra Milestone, they also launched our latest podcast, A Nice Place to Visit, which is a Twilight Zone podcast they're doing exclusively through our Patreons. We brought this up last week, that Sam and Adonis are creating bonus exclusive podcasts just for our loyal patrons. The good news is you don't have to totally miss out if you're not one of our patrons. You actually can listen to the first episode of both of these shows, A Nice Place to Visit, the Twilight Zone podcast, and Game Over Man, the Alien and Predators movies podcast. Those are both on Patreon right now. Both of them have their first episodes. They come out every other week, respectively. Definitely check that out using the show notes. I'm going to finish out the patron stuff before we talk about TIFF things, actually. So first, want to thank our newest patron, Jameson. Thank you so much for joining our Patreon. I'm very curious. You know, we messaged you and I forgot to ask, what was it? Was it Game Over Man or was it Twilight Zone? Was it Will Ashton himself being awesome?
I think I actually know Jameson. If it's the Jameson I know, I think I know this guy.
Well, you'll have to clear the air with him because I don't know him.
Well, yeah, I'd have to know his last name. But yeah, okay. If it is the guy who I think it is, that's really awesome. Thank you. And obviously, if it isn't, still awesome. Thank you. But that's cool.
So yeah, I expected as soon as Abby joined the show, people would be like, all right, this seems like a podcast worth donating to. So thank you, Abby.
Shucks. Thank you. Thank you so much. I appreciate the flattery. You can keep on doing it anytime.
So like I said, we have merch on the Patreon right now. And here's the thing. We have custom merch that we can do, right? I know you just want to have fun, goof off, and I do too. But we got important economic business to take care of. So let's say you're a listener, you want a Cinemaholics hoodie, you want a Cinemaholics t-shirt, or you're like Will Ashton and you want a Cinemaholics shot glass. Now we can facilitate this for you. The only thing is, it's weird. So if you go into our Patreon, you'll see that there are exclusive tiers for like the merch. However, if you are a $2 patron or you are a $5 patron and you want any of these merch products or more, but you don't want to pay tons of money, which we kind of don't want you to, we just want you to, you know, wear the Cinemaholics logo if you want to. Link up with us on Patreon. That's all you got to do. Link up with us there or email us and we will work with you to get whatever merch you want. We don't have like an e-commerce store for this. This is really lo-fi, folks. I'm just going to say it. We're amateurs, but you know, we want to do this in a fun way and we want to make this available to everybody. So if you are interested in Cinemaholics merch, hit us up. Again, our email is cinemaholicspodcast@gmail.com or hit us up via Patreon if you're already a patron. Hope you all enjoy the merch that is to come. Okay, enough of all that stuff. I want to hear from Will and Abby because, Will, you know, we had our TIFF recap episode. It was really fun. Everybody loved it. Oh, billions good. Of downloads, I think.
Oh, wow.
And we had a listener who said they wanted to hear more about Holler. And I think Abby wanted to ask about a few TIFF movies, Will, that you didn't get a chance to talk about. So here's our TIFF epilogue segment,
sure,
if you will.
Yeah, I mean, I saw quite a few films, so I didn't get a chance to talk about quite a few of them. But I'm glad someone wanted to hear a little bit more and they weren't put off by how much I had to say about TIFF. But as far as Holler itself, this is the directorial debut of Nicole Riegel. This is the film with Jessica Barden, and it was the first movie I actually saw at Virtual TIFF. So it was my inaugural film, I guess, my introduction to the festival. And I will say that I don't want to like repeat too much that I wrote in my review because that was the first review I wrote as well. So if you wanted to hear some of my more in-depth thoughts, they're there as well. But as far as the movie itself, I really dug it for the first half. I really love its sense of place and that it was able to get us into this fairly depressing and worn down city, but in a way that felt very vibrant. And, you know, you could see a lot of the life and activity going on here. I definitely think Nicole, as a first time filmmaker, has a really good sense of place and style. And she also shot it in 16mm, which I think makes the movie look really nice. And I really was taken by Jessica Barton's performance. I haven't had as much experience with her work. I haven't watched It's the End of the Effing World, which I know is a show that John loves a lot, and he's very mad that I haven't seen it. But
hey, you have seen Lobster, which is another good performance from her.
Yeah, although that was a supporting turn. This is a lead, and it does feel like, I don't really know what the genre is, but it does feel like there's like this kind of rite of passage for like young women doing movies where like they're in these worn down industrial towns. Like there's like Winter's Bone and Leave No Trace and like Martha May Marlene and like all these different movies where it kind of feels like once you get to a certain place, you have to do like indie like this. And I mean, I will say, I think for me, what ultimately took the film down was that it felt very by the numbers by a certain point, and I felt that took away from the authenticity that was being established in the opening moments and the deeper kind of more relevant themes that are going on kind of felt watered down by what felt like a very kind of written and overwritten film. But as far as the performances and the direction, I thought it was really well done. And it was a good way to ease myself into this virtual film festival. So it's a solid film. I don't know when it's coming out. I don't know if it's been bought up yet, but it's worth a watch. Just I would say maybe temper your expectations for the second half, because I just don't think they quite match the promise of the first half. But it's a solid film all around.
Special thanks to the listener, by the way, who asked us to talk more about Holler. And then now, Abby, because you had some films that you wanted to ask Will about.
I did. I wanted to ask you about a couple of films that I know you guys didn't get to cover fully on your initial podcast. Can you tell me a little bit about Concrete Cowboy and also Another Round? Because those are two that I was super curious about.
Yeah, those are two that I was hoping to talk about, and unfortunately I didn't get a chance to in our main ep, so I'm glad you gave me this opportunity. Yeah, Concrete Cowboy is the directorial debut of Ricky Staub, S-T-A-U-B. I don't know if I'm, again, I don't know if I'm pronouncing any of these names correct ever, but this is the movie where it's Idris Elba in a cowboy hat and on a horse. That's like the only real image they showed us. I was like, is this going to be a Western with Idris Elba? Like, hell yeah, like, why not? Because, you know, like there was a Dark Tower, which was similar idea. It's like a Western with Idris Elba. He has a hat, or he didn't have a hat in that movie, but he should have had a hat. But it's like, yeah, finally we get to see him playing a Western star. And that's not exactly what this is. This is actually more of a coming of age story centered around Caleb McLaughlin, who is from Stranger Things most prominently. He is a troubled youth who is having a hard time fitting in. This is like mostly coming of age story where he is not really fitting in with his mom, and she's overworked and frustrated. So she sends him to his dad, who's been mostly out of the picture for most of his life. He lives in North Philadelphia, but he raises these horses, and it kind of has that quirky Sundance feel throughout, where it's like tackling some very serious things, but there's like kind of like a lightheartedness with all of like the cowboy elements of it. But it's also a film similar to Nomadland in that it incorporates both actors and non-actors pretty seamlessly in a way that I was really impressed by. And I didn't even realize that a lot of these people were non-actors until after the film, when they were just like, yeah, like this is why I decided to do the film. I'm not really an actor, and so and so. So I was really impressed by that. And I do really like how much passion and enthusiasm was put into the film. It's clear that Stab is a first-time filmmaker, is really coming out of the gate with a clear passion and interest in doing something as a filmmaker, and definitely showcasing a sense of style that I don't think is fully honed yet, but it's very clear that he wants to make an impression. I think he definitely has a solid future ahead of him. This is another film, though, where I feel like it's so mechanical as far as the plotting is concerned. It falls for a very predictable turn of events, and I think that takes away from what I was really enjoying about the film, which is the kind of more casual and the quirky elements of it that I think were standing out. But performances all around are really good. Obviously Idris Elba is really strong, but he is definitely more of a supporting actor in this than I think the small marketing so far has suggested. It's more Caleb McLaughlin's movie, but he does a nice job. I think it's a good showcase for him. And Method Man's in this as well, and I think he's become quite a good actor in the past few years, even though he hasn't really had a lot of projects to shine. I think he has definitely stepped up and done some really solid stuff as an actor. And so another film that I liked a good bit. I don't think this is like as good as I was hoping it would be, but it's a solid film all around. And I think both of you will probably like it when it comes out.
Good. An important follow-up question. Does Method Man ride a horse in the movie? I want to know.
Yeah. At one brief moment, he does ride a horse.
All right.
So, yeah.
Fantastic. So tell me about Another Round, because I enjoy both Mads Mikkelsen and Thomas Vinterberg, and the trailer for this looked really interesting as well.
Oh, cool. I didn't even know there was a trailer yet, so that's good to know. But yeah, this is their follow-up to, was it 2012 when The Hunt came out? The original Hunt.
I was about to say, wasn't that long ago? Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, 2012, 2013.
Yeah, I mean, I know this is their follow-up since then. I actually haven't seen the original Hunt. I mean, not original, like the new one's a remake, but like the other film that came out the past few years that was also called The Hunt. But this film, the premise of it is that it's four high school teachers who are entering this sort of like midlife crisis period. They're all basically not happy with where they are in life. Mads Mikkelsen in particular is kind of losing his lust for teaching. Like, he's kind of losing that spark that got him into the job in the first place. His marriage isn't quite in a stable place. And they have an experiment. I forget which philosopher proposed this, but saying that basically a human's supposed to be at least like 0.5% or so drunk at all times. Like that's how you achieve your maximum potential. And that's like how you kind of find your like enjoyment for life again. So they all take an experiment where they basically go throughout their lives being at least marginally drunk for like work and like their personal lives and all this stuff, just to kind of see if there is a like renewed sense of like vibrant passion and interest in what they're doing. And sure enough, once they start drinking during situations where they really shouldn't be drinking, they do find that interest and that enthusiasm. However, things don't quite go as they would expect, but you know, maybe as you might anticipate as you watch this go on. It's a good film, though. I mean, I definitely think the script isn't quite as strong as the acting and the performances or the direction. I mean, but I think it comes together really well. I definitely appreciate the sense of dramatics, but it's also like able to feel somewhat real, which I think kind of helps hurdle some of the more like kind of far-fetched aspects of the film that I wasn't quite as crazy about. But as far as the movie itself, it's solid. I don't think it's like as good as their previous effort from what I've been told, but it's a solid film all around. And I would say it's good. It's worth watching.
That's good to know. Thank you.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you, Will, for covering the TIFF beat so thoroughly for us. And as we enter the fall season, I know there's a lot of films premiere that have just premiered at TIFF that are premiering right now at New York Film Festival that are definitely going to be on our radar. We're definitely going to be talking more about in the coming months. But one thing we've also been talking more and more about in the last year, for reasons that are pretty obvious to anyone listening in 2020, is streaming originals. We've talked about a lot of streaming movies. We've talked about exclusive series that have come out, maybe miniseries that have made quite an impression. And what can happen is that so much content flies at us. There's so much that we forget, okay, there's some stuff that we didn't see. There's some stuff that maybe we need to check out, maybe that flew under the radar. This happened with me recently when I caught up on things like Lovecraft Country, and before that, finally finished Watchmen, stuff like that. So our latest listener voicemail segment is just that. We asked all of you listeners on that app, the Swell app, if you don't have it yet, what is a recent streaming series or movie you wish more people had seen? Now, we got a lot of responses to this. People were itching to tell us what they have been watching that they wish, you know, maybe it's not something that we, you know, haven't talked about ever on the show, but they do feel kind of more like underseen, if that makes sense. So we're going to play one answer now, and I'm thinking maybe we can come back to these voicemails and play some of the other responses since there are a good number. But for now, here is what Phil had to say.
So there's definitely a show that I have been watching recently that I feel is flying under the radar, and that is Doom Patrol on HBO Max. For those of you listening that are not familiar with Doom Patrol, it's sort of a ragtag group of heroes. I guess you could call them heroes. They're sort of thrust into it unwillingly at first, but I don't think many of them are super recognizable faces. With that being said, Cyborg is one of the characters, and I feel like it's just a really fun, wild ride and sort of a breath of fresh air when you think about all the other comic book content that's out right now. That's just a little bit I guess generic, or has run its course, you could say. Some of the actors on the show that I think really stand out: Alan Tudyk is on the show, absolutely wonderful as always. And Brendan Fraser actually makes his, I guess you could call it, return. I know he was in a film recently, but I haven't seen him do too much as of late. And it's always lovely to hear his voice. Someone that grew up with him basically being like an action hero for me. I really appreciate having him on the show. So yeah, Doom Patrol, HBO Max, really recommend it.
All right, that was Phil. And once again, if you want to leave us a voicemail as well, all you have to do is get the Swell app on iOS or Android. Find our account. It's linked, of course, in the show notes. Cinemaholics Podcast. We ask prompts every week, sometimes more than once a week. And yeah, I hope people have been checking out Doom Patrol, because I do remember at one point we talked about this show when it first came out. I think it was in 2018. I was the only one who had seen it, and I had been curious about it. I think I was the only one. I don't want to speak for Will and I think Maverick at the time, but I saw it because I was really curious about, you know, it was the first time I had seen Brendan Fraser in anything since maybe that Mummy sequel, the third one. So yeah, I know I've been hearing though ever since I stopped watching that this show has gone off the rails and then some, but in the best way possible. I've been meaning to catch up on it, especially because it used to only be available on DC Universe, that streaming app. Now it's, as Phil mentioned, it's also available on HBO Max. So Will, Abby, I guess start with Abby. Do you have plans to check out Doom Patrol, or are you waiting?
I do, actually. I would like to check out Doom Patrol. It's been on my to watch list for a while. I am kind of sort of familiar with those characters in the comic sense, and there's a lot of really weird and interesting creative ways that that can go. I remember when the show was announced that my first reaction was just kind of surprise as to how they were going to actually depict some of the characters in that lineup. But yeah, I've been hearing really great things and I'm curious about it.
Yeah, that's a good point, because I think people in our generation, most of us probably know Doom Patrol more readily from Teen Titans, because there was a whole arc in that show. It was obviously a pretty popular show in its day. And I don't know too many people who actually read the comics for Doom Patrol before this series. So that's interesting to hear. But okay, Will, Doom Patrol, I can't remember if you've watched this at all, so if you can set the record straight.
Yeah, no, I haven't. I'm very behind on TV in general. Yeah, so I haven't had a chance to see this one. I know it was on their thing before. Was it DC Fandom or something?
DC Universe.
DC Universe. Yeah, Fandom was the Comic-Con thing they had. But yeah, I haven't watched it. I didn't have that service. But I remember, I think Adonis Gonzalez is a big fan of this show, if I recall correctly.
He is,
correctly.
He's been telling me and Sam to get on that.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, I'm sure it's good. I love Brendan Fraser. I'm always happy to see him working. It brings a smile to my face to see him doing something, especially if it's well-liked. So I'm happy for him. You know, if I never get around to watch this show, I'm just happy that he's working and hopefully having a good time.
All right, well, thank you, Phil, for the recommendation. Hopefully some listeners will check it out per your voicemail and enjoy it just as much as you have. All right, that'll do it for definitely a pretty loaded off-topics section, which makes sense because we don't have as many reviews this week as usual, but I think we will make it count in every single one of these discussions. Let's start with our first review, Enola Holmes.
Now, where to begin? My mother named me Enola, which backwards spells alone. And yet, we were always together. It was wonderful. She was my whole world. Which leads me on to the second thing you need to know. A week ago, I awoke.
Mother?
To find that my mother was missing, and she did not return.
I'm presently on the way to collect my brothers, Mycroft and Sherlock.
Yes, Sherlock Holmes, the famous detective, my genius brother. He will have all the answers.
Enola.
Where's your hat and your gloves?
Well, I have a hat. Just makes my head itch. And I have no gloves.
My God.
A wild woman brought up a wild child.
We'll make her acceptable for society.
She seems intelligent.
There are two paths you can take, Enola. Yours, or the path others choose for you.
It is time to find my mother.
The game is afoot.
Enola Holmes is the latest Netflix original. And I think it was originally supposed to be a theatrical release through Warner Brothers, if I'm not mistaken, but it is now under the Netflix and Legendary Pictures banner. This film, actually, part of the reason it came about was because Millie Bobby Brown, who is starring and is a producer, really believed in the source material. This is based on a book series by Nancy Springer. It's also called Enola Holmes. And this movie is apparently loosely based on the first book. It's kind of the same story as the first book with extra stuff thrown in. And yeah, Millie Bobby Brown, fresh off of her just global success on Stranger Things, managed to get a lot of people involved into making this kind of hybrid streaming service / theatrical movie that I think has a very impressive budget for typically what we see from Netflix in this genre, which that's the first positive thing I'll say. But then also the reviews have been really positive. I think I don't know a ton of people who have seen this in real life, like people I know outside of like film circles, but film critics are definitely fans of Enola Holmes. So I'm going to start with you, Abby Olchesi. What is this movie all about? It sounds like Enola has something to do with a detective we all know and love.
Actually, that's a misnomer. Just kidding. No, Enola is Sherlock Holmes's younger sister. And so the premise is that, I mean, she's significantly younger than both Sherlock and Mycroft Holmes, and was raised by their mother alone, kind of on their estate in the country. And their mother, played by Helena Bonham Carter, is a fiercely independent person.
Best homeschooler, best homeschooling mother, parent, teacher ever, in my opinion.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. More like homeschooling. Oh,
yeah, I was just about to do that.
there's that pun.
All right.
But yeah, she raises Enola to be kind of a multi-hyphenate. She's good at a lot of things. She can do like jujitsu. She can do word games. She's good at science. She's kind of got everything going for her. But on the morning of her 16th birthday, mom goes missing under mysterious circumstances, and Enola wants to figure out what's going on, where her mom has gone. And so she gets Sherlock and Mycroft to come and help her figure it out. But as soon as they arrive, both of them deem her kind of unfit for society, essentially. And Mycroft especially wants her to go to a finishing school. So Enola decides that she's going to try to solve this whole thing on her own. And she goes to London, at which point she becomes embroiled in a different case involving a young kind of highborn lord who is on the run from a mysterious assassin who shows up right when they first meet and then kind of trails both of them throughout the rest of the movie. There's kind of a lot going on plot-wise. John, when you mentioned that there's some extra stuff thrown in, there's kind of a lot of extra stuff thrown in. But apart from the kind of over plottiness of it, there's a lot to like here. It's a pretty charming movie.
Yeah, I misspoke earlier. Technically, the book this is based on is not of the same name. It's actually called The Enola Holmes Mysteries, The Case of the Missing Marquess, which is, of course, what, as you mentioned, that's kind of the main mystery, but they have other stuff thrown in as well. This movie is pretty long. It's 123 minutes. I thought it felt pretty long. I was surprised when certain things happen in this plot, and I'm like, wow, we are not that far along, are we? But yes, I want to get into a lot of things here. I want to hear what Will has to say opinion-wise. I'm going to start out by saying I don't really like this movie that much. I don't know if I'm going to be more negative than you two, but I guess we'll start with Will here. What did you think of Enola Holmes? Did you like it? Is that the case?
I don't know. I thought it was fine. Like, I'm not really negative or positive on it right now. I was kind of hoping the discussion would sway me one way or the other, just because I think it's primarily meant to be, as you said, like a showcase for Millie Bobby Brown, a star vehicle for her as a star and producer. And I think in that case, it's fine. You know, I think it works. Like, she gives a pretty, you know, lively and obviously inspired performance. And I think she's trying to make the most of it. And I think that's fine. I just don't really think the movie itself around her is all that much to write home about. And I think it primarily just comes down to pacing, like you said. Like, I think the beginning's strong, where it's just like very zippy and has Harry Bradbeer's style that's very reminiscent of Fleabag, which he directed most of, I think, everything but the like series premiere he did. And, you know, it's obviously, you know, with the like fourth wall smashing and like all the direct meta references to like the story and stuff, like, it's, you know, it's clear why they got him involved. I don't know if that became the case, like if the script was written that way and then like he was like, oh, well, you know, makes sense you hired me, or if it like he got involved and was like, hey, what if the camera what if the person spoke to the camera, and it was just like, oh, sure, whatever. I'm not sure which one is the case, but yeah, as the movie itself, I think I don't know if it's a casting issue, but I never really felt like Sam Chaplin and Henry Cavill were like the right people for their parts. And it's not that they do a bad job, it's just that, well, for one, Sam Chaplin's supposed to be older than Henry Cavill, which is weird because he's clearly younger. Not only is he like younger in real life, but he looks younger. So I was like, okay, that's an odd choice. But I never really felt like they were their characters. It felt like the actors were performing their characters, especially for Henry Cavill. And that's fine because he's like a fairly charismatic person. But just was like, what if Sherlock Holmes was Henry Cavill? And it's like, that's kind of amusing, but it doesn't fit the character. So I wasn't able to like kind of suspend my disbelief in that regard. And I never really felt like the stuff they added in, particularly with the love interest character, was that interesting or investing. Just kind of felt like it padded out the film from like the whole mother story, which I think was like the main thrust. And it felt like that kind of just got thrown to the side a lot, to the point where I was never fully able to get invested in this thing. But it is like fairly zippy and snappy otherwise. And I think, you know, like I said, I think Millie Bobby Brown is inspired and wants to make a good film here. And I don't think it's bad for showcasing her early talents, but as a movie, I just think it's kind of like so-so.
Yeah, unfortunately, I agree with most of what you said there. I hope that Abby cheers us up a little bit, but it'll be sad if that's not the case. I want to say real fast and hear from you, Abby, on this particular issue when you say your overall thoughts. I think Sam Claflin is well cast here, in addition to Millie Bobby Brown. I agree, though, with Henry Cavill. I just know, like, this doesn't work. And I think that Sam Claflin, I can almost sort of halfway buy. He's a guy in his like late 20s, or early 30s, which is what this character is supposed to be. But Henry Cavill does not look young, which, you know, that's a good thing in his case. I think he's a strapping gentleman who could be James Bond. But I think, like, yeah, this movie does not understand what I think what Henry Cavill is good at as an actor, or what is interesting about Sherlock Holmes as a character. And so it doesn't do either well at all, in my opinion. I just think this character is a blank, boring pillar that I was glad whenever he was not on the screen, because I just thought it was more distracting than anything else. But I did think Sam Claflin, it's a different take on Mycroft than we're used to. It's a younger version of him where he's a bit more abrasive and just kind of a jerk, a foil. But I thought, you know, that, okay, do something different with Sherlock Holmes mythology. That makes sense. But then if you're going to do that, I don't know. I feel like Sherlock Holmes deserves a little bit more characterization and writing beyond Henry Cavill being like, all right, is this, when are we filming Witcher? I like doing that because I can be monotone on purpose. But anyway, Abby Olchesi, a lot has been said so far, but where do you stand?
I know you guys are bumming me out. I really enjoyed this movie. I do think that it is a little overly plotty, and you kind of do feel the lengths at certain points. I think that there are a few sequences, a couple storylines that could probably be shortened or removed. I think the stuff with Enola going to the finishing school doesn't really do a whole lot for the overall plot and just kind of makes things a little bit longer. It feels padded in certain points. But I like the performances kind of across the board, actually. I think Millie Bobby Brown is just incredibly charming as Enola, and I think this is a great opportunity for her to kind of stretch a little bit as a performer. We're used to seeing her in Stranger Things, where her lines are unfortunately fairly limited. And this kind of allows her to be kind of full and vibrant and knowledgeable. And she really seems like a different person, which I think was kind of part of the point. And I think it does that job admirably. For Henry Cavill, I would agree that the part is a little bit underwritten. I don't think that he is necessarily wrong for it. I'd kind of like to see sort of a witchery take on Sherlock from him. I think that could be great. He does grumpy and monotone very well, which I think that character can also do very well when put in certain situations. But I do think that he kind of is allowed to exude the sort of big brotherly concern part of it, which is really what most of that character is supposed to be. It's not his movie, it's Enola's movie, and I think that the film does a good job of focusing more specifically on her and bringing those characters in when it's necessary to do so. But yeah, I enjoyed it kind of across the board. I think the plot with the young Marquess, who she kind of gets involved with, was I was disappointed in where I thought it might go. Fortunately, it doesn't go all the way there. There's enough independence is still allowed that it doesn't totally ruin the entire experience. But yeah, I think overall, apart from the length, I think this is something that a lot of people I think this is something that a lot of families can enjoy together, which is not something you can say for a lot of the films that have been released during the quarantine period. And it's just kind of a upbeat, fun, generally delightful experience, which again is something that I feel has been kind of lacking in a lot of releases this year, mostly because they got delayed. So I'm thankful for this one.
Yeah, you know, I think for the most part I am on board with what this movie is trying to do. I think that the style that Harry Bradbeer brings to, like, what a Fleabag but for kids, yeah, I mean, I think that is a fun sort of technique that I don't mind seeing it in other things. And I think part of the reason it actually works in this movie for the most part is because I think, as we all have basically said, this is Millie Bobby Brown's movie. And she is just, I really appreciate what you said about how this is a great opportunity, Abby, for her to really stretch and show what she's capable of beyond Stranger Things and that Godzilla movie. Because I think in both of those things, yeah, she's kind of forced to be more of this restrained, kind of, you know, reserved character, which is fine for those properties. But I like seeing this more electric. And I think charming is the veritable word for her in this. And, you know, I kind of have quipped a little bit that I think as Americans, we can be a little bit too easily charmed by British films, I'm starting to suspect. But that's a conversation for another day. I think this movie overall is pretty successful for both Millie Bobby Brown and Netflix and any future movies for this, because I think it is going to hit a sweet spot for its target audience. I just don't think that on the whole, it's going to really be a very lasting thing. It feels like a setup for something much better to me. And one of my biggest criticism with this, honestly, you've mentioned the pacing and just some of the things that happen in the movie that are like, this feels a little like unnecessary. For me, what really hurt this movie for me, what really like took me out of what the parts I was invested in, was the fact that the mystery itself, I just thought was very stupid. And I just didn't think the way all this stuff connects was worthy of, like, I know she's the younger sister of Sherlock Holmes, but like even Sherlock Jr., young Sherlock Holmes, like, you know, usually those mysteries can be surprising and they can, and the deduction going into it is supposed to be very fun. And it's supposed to be like, oh, wow, I didn't even think of that. And this, like, I feel like most of the audience is going to know exactly what the thing is, like, who, okay, that's the bad guy, clearly. You know, like, everyone's gonna, not everyone, but most people are gonna like pick that out. I don't think this movie is for an audience that's so young that they would totally miss that, especially because like then the third act happens, and not to give anything away, some pretty violent, like pretty graphic violent stuff happened to the point where I was like, wow,
yeah, I
didn't
say,
watch this with anybody, like kids.
No, I just was gonna agree, like, I was kind of surprised that you said that, Abby, because I was like, the ending gets pretty violent. Like, I was not expecting it to get violent. So I was like surprised when I was like, okay. So guys, well, I can't say what, but like it what happened, I was surprised it got that violent.
Yeah, I think the climax especially is it's a little surprising, but I mean, if you think about the particular age group that is probably gonna watch this the most, which is, I guess it would be a little bit much for like a 12-year-old, but for a 16 to 17-year-old, maybe not so much. But this is also coming from somebody whose parents made her watch PBS mystery shows from like age 6. So I'm pretty used to seeing a lot of this stuff already. I don't know. I wasn't super bothered by it. I was a little surprised, but I don't think anybody's going to be completely turned off by it. At least I hope they won't be.
Yeah, kids don't mind. They'll be right. Like, yeah, violence.
Yeah, I mean, I thought that I'm like appalled by it. I mean, I was like, you know, I was kind of for it. I was like, okay, I'm surprised you took this risk. I was just more surprised just because, like, for the most of the movie, it was kind of genial in that respect. And then just out of nowhere, it just gets super violent. It was just like, okay, that's a total yeah. departure. Sure.
Might as well go there. Yeah, I think maybe I'm over analyzing this movie in general. But yeah, as we kind of get into our final thoughts and everything, I think the last big thing I would add is just, I think what's great about this character is that she does have agency. She does sort of exist in an interesting world with obstacles that make sense. And she has an arsenal of, you know, tricks and skills that are, those things are surprising. Those things make her fun to watch. I think like her tenacity with like word puzzles and ciphers and lots of things that like we know from like the Sherlock Holmes story, but they sort of are doing that with a character, including the fighting, which I think is pretty cool. Like the fight scenes she gets to be in are fun to watch. I think all that stuff works because unlike Sherlock Holmes, she's a character who kind of is like, I can have more of a heart. I can have more of like a heart and soul compared to my older brothers. And that is what sets her apart. And that's what I think makes the story come into its own. I think the problem though is that part of Sherlock Holmes, what we expect from this sort of story is a really good mystery and a character who is solving a mystery. And I think that the movie tries to act like she's solving a mystery, but she's more reactionary despite all the agency that she's applying. The mystery kind of just sort of gets solved around her and things just sort of happen coincidentally that, you know, along the way, like she has little like deductive reasoning things. But yeah, I just never felt like she was taking control of the mystery in a way that was satisfying to watch. And I think part of that is because the mystery itself was just really on its face. That's what I hope in the sequel, they are a little bit smarter, a little bit deeper with it. And it's a more challenging puzzle because I think that would be really great. And then also maybe recast Henry Cavill, but that's just me. Okay, Will Ashton, I want Abby to go last on final thoughts because we should end on a positive note. I give this thing a pretty low B minus, but what about you? How would you sum up your thoughts on this one?
I'm not too far from where you are. I was between a low B minus and a high C plus. I think I'm going to give it the high C plus just because I just don't think there's enough here that really connected with me. And admittedly, this isn't really a movie made for me. This is made for like teens to like preteens, like Zoomer age people right now. So like I get that, like I'm not the target audience here and I'm not really asking to be for me anyway. So I take that into account. But I also think the movie itself, like, I do agree with you. Like, I kind of wish there was something here that separated from Sherlock Holmes. Like, I wish he was smart in like kind of like different ways to make it a little bit more like her own character. It just kind of felt like she was in between that. Like, it felt like she was kind of doing her own thing, but also she was like Sherlock Holmes Jr. And it never really felt like it had that balance quite right. And like you said, like, I don't think the mystery itself really invests me enough to the point where I could kind of overlook that. I don't know. I just think there's something here. I think Millie Bobby Brown's committing to it in a fun way. And I agree, if there is a sequel, like, I think they could kind of, you know, iron out some of these flaws and kind of figure it out and maybe make a really solid sequel to this and figure it out. But as it stands, I think it's just fine. Like, it's not bad. Like, I think as a streaming exclusive, it makes a lot of sense to put this on Netflix because it's a fairly breezy watch, overlong, but, you know, comfortable in most respects. So, yeah, a C plus, like, not a mean C plus or like angry C plus, just kind of more like, yeah, fine, C plus, you know, like,
sure.
I didn't waste my time with it, but it's not really something I would have seeked out if we weren't reviewing it on the show. So didn't really invest me, didn't really grab me. But as a stance, yeah, it's fine. It's a C plus.
Before we get to Abby, one quick thing that I forgot to mention that you brought up, Will. You were curious if they added the Harry Radbeer thing to the script. I think they did because, correct me if I'm wrong, there are large chunks of this movie where there isn't like a fourth wall breaking thing for a while. And yeah. I was keeping track. I was like, is this still a thing? And so that felt to me like they added it in and sort of like after the script was done. So that's just my opinion. That's sort of what I suspect.
No, I was going to say, because there's like one point where it's like they don't do it for a while. And then she like looks at the audience like, why aren't you figuring this out? It's like, I'm still involved. I'm like, what are you yelling at me for? Yeah, so it does feel like that's kind of like not maybe reshot stuff, but like something that was kind of added in later on.
Yeah. All right, well, that's enough of our little bummer summer. Abby, please tell the listeners why we need to chill out and why this one is good, actually.
With pleasure. I think it's not necessarily a masterpiece, but I think it is a fun and entertaining movie. And I feel like in the particular context that we're in, that's something that we're kind of missing. And I feel like especially movies of this quality for younger viewers or for families at large are kind of in short supply. And so I'm pretty happy that there is one that I think a lot of people can watch together and enjoy. So that's really the main thing that gives me sort of a positive bent on this. But also I think Millie Bobby Brown's performance is just completely charming and a lot of fun to watch. And I feel like that buoys it along as well. It's very pretty to look at. It has some very nice aesthetics. You can tell that this had a higher budget because everything looks gorgeous. And yeah, I think I enjoyed it overall. I think it's a fun movie for families to watch together. I think it's kind of empowering for younger women. I feel like the mystery itself may be a little bit obvious, but part of the fun of watching a movie with a mystery is to figure it out yourself. And when you're that young, maybe your deductive reasoning powers aren't that high anyway. So being able to figure it out easily is a nice way to feel empowered. So I'll give it that. But yeah, overall, I would say probably a solid B from me.
All right. So a C plus, B minus, and B from us, which means there's no average. It is just what it is. And you probably already know if you want to check it out. Enola Holmes is streaming on Netflix right now. Let's move into our next film. This one, a very drastic departure from what we've talked about. This one's not for the kids. This is Kajillionaire, the new comedy slash crime drama film. It's written and directed by Miranda July, who is an indie darling in many respects as a director. I haven't seen all of her films, but I have seen a handful. And I should say, I talked about this film already this year because saw this back at Sundance. I didn't have a chance to watch it again. It's not actually available on VOD quite yet. That'll be the case on October 16th. So happy late birthday for me. But this is from Focus Features and it's in theaters right now. As usual, I don't recommend you go see this in a theater. I think you should just wait. Not worth the risk, in my opinion, especially if you live in the U.S., That said, this is one of my favorite movies of the entire year. I love Kajillionaire. The soundtrack just came out and I have been just powering through it. And I've had a lot of time to think about this movie. I had a lot of time to sort of wrap up my own thoughts on what the deal is. I'll say real quick, it stars Evan Rachel Wood. It stars Richard Jenkins, Deborah Ringer, Gina Rodriguez. It's a pretty great cast. And I think I want to turn it over to you this time, Will Ashton. What is the setup for this movie? And what did you think of Kajillionaire?
The setup, that's going to be a tricky one to to break down. Yeah,
that's why so, I gave it to you, because, you know.
Sure. Yeah, so the movie follows Odolia, who is Evan Rachel Wood's character, and she is a, I believe, 26-year-old woman who has been close-knit with her kind of oddball parents for her whole life, and they are a couple of, like, grifters who've, throughout their whole lives, or not their whole lives, most of their lives, have just kind of swindling and trying to find ways to like take what they want out of life, and just figuring that everyone around them is kind of like trying to like bamboozle them or like take advantage of them in some way. So it's just like we're just kind of cheating the system every time. And they have this like ongoing sense of paranoia as well, because they think that there's going to be like this humongous earthquake that will like basically consume them, and like, you know, life is basically short anyway, so like why bother being so worried about the trivialities of it? Just kind of take what you can get and have fun with it. And at this point in her life, because she has been so distant and like so basically made to be paranoid about everyone around her, that she has no emotional intimacy with anybody, including her parents. And when they're planning their latest scheme to figure out their rent for the office building-ish place that they live in, they come into contact with Gina Rodriguez's character, who is this bright, kind of bubbly personality. She lives a kind of like, I don't want to say like shelter existence, but she hasn't really had as much fun in her life as this family trio has. So she wants in on it. She wants to figure out like what their whole deal is. She's very intrigued and amused by their antics. And so she gets into the dynamic. And from there, we see that Odolio is able to realize that like life isn't quite what she thought it was. Like there's ways to be very intimate and ways to be like kind of more open, more human, essentially, without the ways that her parents have suggested throughout her life. So it's like kind of learning to like leave the nest while also finding yourself at a later point in life, which is definitely a type of stories I like. And I also really enjoy Miranda July's past two films. So I definitely had fun with this, but I want to hear from you two first.
Yeah, the listeners already know where I'm at, but so turn it over to you, Abby Olchesi. First of all, you know, I don't know if you've seen some of July's other films, if this is maybe a first watch for you, but yeah, where are you at with her filmography? I know she's only made like three at this point, and it's been years since the last one, but yeah, what did you think of those, and what did you think of Kajillionaire?
Yeah, in general, I've really liked Miranda July's output as a filmmaker and also as a writer. She's written a couple of short story collections and I think a novel as well that are all kind of similarly quirky and thematically deep. I think she's a filmmaker that a lot of people, I think in her early stuff especially, people liked to write off as just kind of quirk for quirk's sake. But those folks are not really looking at the kind of thematic depth that she has, which usually has to deal with relationship and connection and the human need for it. And I think there's a lot of that in this movie in a way that's really kind of profound. I'm still kind of wrapping my head around how I felt about it, because I feel like there's a lot of themes in there that I think are universally applicable, but the way they apply in the film is so specific to one person's experience that I'm kind of having a hard time into like kind of digging out a larger lesson or goal or point from the film. I know it's there. I just need to kind of think about it a little harder. But in general, I think it's a really interesting film, and I think it's a really interesting setup as well. Evan Rachel Wood gives an amazing performance, kind of disappears into that role. She's got this long hair that goes over her shoulders, and her posture is awful. Like she just kind of stoops and leans forward. She's got these giant glasses and this really deep voice, and she wears very baggy clothes. It takes you a second to realize that that's who it is. And she's also, her character is also very uncomfortable with human touch. There's a hilarious scene early on where she gets a gift certificate to a massage therapist, and she is so uncomfortable with physical touch that in order for it to be a comfortable experience for her, the massage therapist can't touch her, just like kind of holds her hand over her back.
Yeah.
And she acts like it's the most comfortable she's ever felt. which is, it's pretty great. And it's pretty telling about her character. I feel like Gina Rodriguez's presence in it is great in that it kind of grounds everything in reality. It tells us that this is not what's normal for the characters is not necessarily what's normal for the world. Like, it is still our world. And I appreciate the perspective that she brings to that, as well as how she kind of helps Evan Rachel Wood's character, Old Dolio, who's named after a homeless man that they hoped would give her money by naming their child after her. I feel like that it helps to illustrate the reality of the dynamic between those characters and the necessity of relationship and kind of what happens when you want to have a healthy relationship with your parents, but your parents are inherently unhealthy people. So yeah, there's a lot going on there. I'm still kind of figuring out where I stand on it fully, but it's generally very positive.
Yeah. You know, it's been a long time since I saw this, but for whatever reason, this movie has really just stuck with me. And I think a lot of it is Evan Rachel Wood's performance and just kind of to what you're saying of like the toxicity of this family and her breaking away from that. And just like the quirky comedy in this, to me, there's more to it. Like, there's actual like movie moments in here that are so unexpected, where the music swells up and you're just watching something on the screen that you didn't expect to see, but it's still very emotional and moving. And there aren't a lot of movies that, if I've only seen once and it's been a while, I don't remember the very specific emotional resonance and trigger points of the movie in this way. And that's why I regard it so highly. I think, you know, the soundtrack, as I keep mentioning, is from Emil Mosseri, who did Last Black Man in San Francisco. So with that, I think, I mean, come on, this guy has made my favorite soundtrack of the year 2 years in a row. So I think we just have to give him a lot of credit here. Also, the cinematographer, Sebastian Rintero, I just think adds this like vibrance and life to this movie, the soap thing, you know, and you know, that leads me to my general interpretation of this movie, which is a little out there. But before I will force the listeners to endure my take on Kajillionaire, it's spoiler free for sure. But, you know, obviously, I don't want to jump to it right away. I don't know, just to get to you, Will. Yeah, it sounds like you're still kind of like processing your thoughts on this a little bit, or you're kind of it sounds like this one is a little bit of like a question mark in your head. Is that the case, or am I misreading that?
No, I think you're probably misreading that, because I saw this, I think, 3 weeks ago, like almost a month ago. So I've had a decent amount of time to sit and reflect on it. I've only been positive, I'd say. Like, I mean, I don't know if I was quite as positive as I was when I first saw it. I think I might be a little bit.
That's more of what I'm referring to. Yeah, I wasn't totally sure where you were at.
But I would say, I mean, for me, like, I do agree. Like, I think for some reason, as Abby was suggesting, like, people tend to discredit Miranda July. Like, they kind of assume that like her quirks are her full identity. And for me, it was always a means to the end. Like, even though I don't fully love Me and You and Everybody We Know, but I really appreciate how her style always feels like there's a point to it. Like, there's obviously like big ideas that she's exploring. She just has a kind of unconventional way of doing it. And those moments, like, even though, like, I think of the three, that's probably my least favorite. Like, there's like at least like two or three scenes in that movie that have continued to stick with me, and I've thought about them a lot. And that's the case also with The Future, her follow up film. And with this one, yeah, I mean, like, the scene, without giving too much away, with the like family room where they're reenacting a certain thing. That's my favorite scene of the year. Like, I think that's a tremendous scene, and I really like what it's doing. I love the way the score complements it. I love the way it's shot, as you were saying, like, the cinematography and the score is outstanding. But I mean, that's to me is like Miranda July at her best. Like, that's just what she does. And I think she is communicating so much, and there's so much emotional weight to it, but it's also like fairly approachable. And there is something that's very peculiar about it, but there is a universality to it that makes it very inviting and very sweet. And it's odd, sort of a cute sort of way. And I think that's where Miranda July really excels. And it makes me bummed out that she really doesn't make that many films. But when she does, usually stands out. And I think this is probably, of the three that she's made so far, probably her most accessible film. And it helps that, like, I think Brad Pitt produced this through Plan B, and like, it's a bigger budget than the other films that she's gotten. So I think this one, it's a shame that's coming out in COVID year, so it's not going to get a big theatrical rollout. But I mean, if it did, I think a lot of people would be more willing to approach this one than they would have, I think, her past two films. And I do hope it finds a life on VOD and stuff, because I think it is a really worthwhile film. And I mean, any like mild, like it just because it hasn't fully, I think, stuck with me as much as it has for you, John. I mean, that's not to say I dislike it at all. I really do enjoy this film quite a lot.
Well, and hey, like I said before, this has been a process for me that's been almost a year. So it's not like, even though I really liked it from the get-go and had a pretty positive review for it back in January, I still was sort of trying to figure this movie out. All right, are you both ready for my little theory on this? You can feel free to disagree with it completely.
Sure.
Lay it on me. I'm excited to hear it.
This is what I think July is trying to get at here. I think that she is essentially trying to say that old Dolio is sort of an avatar for this sort of like indie auteur spirit. And I think it's trapped in this family of fellow indie directors and writers who have their own way of doing things, have their own rules for what they think is right and best for their own little world. And as you can imagine, for indie film directors, they're just sort of scraping by day to day. And they're scamming, they're doing things that are maybe not literally scamming, but they're clearly like having to break the rules a lot in order to get things done. And I think this Gina Rodriguez character just sort of represents like this sort of pop bubblegum mentality, this sort of like mainstream personality that wants the sort of like indie movie, but almost more of as like an ornament or as I watched like a quirky movie. And I think this is sort of Miranda July's way of saying that, like, bringing those two things together, there's nothing artistically wrong with that. It's almost sort of saying that, like, there's toxicity in the indie film world, and there is a sort of opportunity she sees for people who might not be the most socially adept, or might not be because of their sort of like individuality, their very individualistic personality, might have a hard time understanding why somebody might like, you know, Demi Lovato music a lot more than, you know, some of the weird stuff on their iPod Nano or what have you. And I think like the coming together of these characters and the relationship of it, I just see it as all a metatextual narrative for film and filmmaking in general. And that's what I got. So go ahead and rip me to shreds.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it was just more about like, I think all of her movies are in a respect about, like you said, individuality and connectivity, but more so about like kind of oddball people just trying to find someone they can connect with, either on a romantic level or like a like familial level or some sort of way. Like obviously me and you and everyone we know is like the advent, the internet age. So it's like all these people at a time when like they're growing more disconnected, trying to find someone they can relate to, and also having the internet be a way of like revealing more about yourself or being more like forthcoming than you might be in person. And then like the future is like her expressing like, how do I know like the person I love is like the one for me? Like, how do I know, like, how do I find that sense of certainty with the person that I'm with? And this is more, I think, like a parenthood kind of thing where I think she just had a child. So it's like the sense of like, oh, like, you know, like now I have a kid, like what responsibilities do I have to like incorporate these themes? Like this sense of like individuality while not like smothering the kid to the point where like, you know, like I feel like I'm overburdening them till they have to like assume like my identity or whatever. And you know, like it's also like, again, like trying to find that person you want in life while also learning that like even the people that like put you into this world you have to like sometimes disconnect with. And so it's that, again, like duality of individuality and connectivity that that was my interpretation of it.
So, and I think that's right. I think that's the text of the movie. I think what I'm talking about is more of like a subtext thing that could be more than just like film as the art form, but I think I just see it as like the subtext being something more abstract and more general in terms of like indie auteur versus pop bubblegum mainstream.
And actually I like the idea that both of those readings can exist in the same space, because I feel like that's very appropriate to Miranda July's style and kind of her drive as an artist who works in a variety of different forms. I feel like that is something that if you were to talk to her about it, she might appreciate. And I think you can read it both ways too. I like looking at it from that perspective, John. I also love the strong kind of parental themes that run throughout that movie and kind of the ways that it tackles ideas of like, what does healthy parental relationship look like? How do I not screw up my kid? How does somebody become a person like old Dolio, which is just such a horrible and sad name. it's almost as if she's been, I think I read a review of this where Thomas Laffley on Roger Ebert, because I'm nothing if not going to direct people to other people who've written about it, says that it's as if she's been punished from birth, which I feel like is very evident in the way that character carries herself and the way that she talks. So yeah, I think there's a lot of ways that you could read this. And I think that's kind of the delightful way of engaging with something that is as artistic as this.
One thing I do love about this movie, and something I love about all like quote unquote like dramedies, is that like every scene could be either like really funny or really sad. I feel like the scene you're talking about earlier with the massage, like to me, like I see the humor in it, and I do chuckle a few times. But for me, that scene is really, really sad. And it's just like I'm saying it's sad and I'm chuckling because, you know, that's who I am. But yeah, I mean, for me, it's like so many scenes in this, like they are funny. I can definitely see the humor. But like when I think back in this movie, I just think about all the melancholy of it and just like how sad it is to be like a person like Odolio. And obviously it's like an exaggeration to some extent, but there are a lot of people who like just live like this. Like there's, I guess it's like a nature nurture kind of thing. Like, was she always going to kind of be a little bit cute like this? But it seems like she's definitely taking the whole like nurture side of this, where it's just like she is a product of her environment. And like, you know, these two people, without fully realizing the extent, have like really messed this girl up from birth onward. And, you know, there's a hopefulness to the ending, but it is also really sad. But I think that's a Miranda July style at its core.
All right, let's wrap things up with our final grades. Abby Olchesi, what's your grade for this one? And anything else you want to add before we move on?
I don't know that there's anything else that I necessarily have to add, but I've appreciated this conversation a lot, and I think it's kind of helped me put the film into a little more context. I do agree with Will, I think it was Will, saying that if this were to get released in a theatrical setting, I feel like this is doubtlessly one of the movies that people would be talking about like throughout the rest of award season. And it is kind of a bummer that same discourse doesn't quite exist this year, but yeah, I think it's a really interesting movie to engage with. It may not be everybody's thing, but I enjoyed it quite a lot. So I'm going to give it an A minus.
All right. And Will Ashton.
Yeah, I mean, for me, with Miranda July, I think she gets better with each film. I don't think people fully agree with that. I think people still like Me and You and Everyone We Know more than the future, which, you know, teach her own. But I think she's only gotten better and more confident and assured as a filmmaker. And I mean, like I said, I'm kind of bummed that she doesn't do this more often. But, you know, when she does grace us with her filmmaking, it always seems worthwhile. I always get a lot out of it. And yeah, like I said, I think this is probably her best one yet. And I really enjoyed it. And yeah, I mean, we've talked a little bit about Evan Rachel Wood. I would echo those statements. I think this is probably my favorite performance from her, if not certainly one of them. I haven't watched Westworld. I don't know if that's her best performance or considered her best performance. But yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, her physicality in this performance is really good. It made me realize that they ever make an Ed and Eddie movie, that she's the person to play Ed, which is not the thought I never thought I'd have before this movie. So I guess kudos to Miranda July for making me realize that. But yeah, no, I really enjoyed this film a lot. And I have mostly very nice things to say about it. And so I'd give it a firm and high B+.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Evan Rachel Wood. I think she's pretty good in Westworld, even though I'm not the biggest fan of Westworld in general. But yeah, I would also say, because she was in Across the Universe too, right? It's probably one of the biggest
films. Yeah, you're a big fan of that one.
Yeah, I like Across the Universe a lot. And I think she's really good in 13 as well.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's probably my favorite from her. But this is close. It's a close second.
Yeah, we might have to have an Evan Rachel Wood episode one of these days, figure out, you know, because I think she's clearly an actor who has just always sort of been on the periphery of like one of our really talented actors in general. But, you know, I think Westworld is what has really launched her into a ton of living rooms. Like, people really know her work now at this point. But all right, my grade for Kajillionaire, I think this could change, because I'm just, you know, it's still an A- because that's what it was the last time I saw it. But I am planning on seeing it again. I could see it going even higher. I could see this being an A film. Because like I've said, I've just progressively and like had more progressively like positive opinions about it as time has gone on. So yeah, we'll see what happens. I could see this one being really high up on my top 10 of 2020, depending on how the next few months go. And I think it already is pretty high up right now. So that is Kajillionaire. Let's move on into our last film of the week. And this, I'm the only one who saw this, I believe. Secret Society of Second Born Royals. Please, I am the only one who saw this, right? I forgot to ask both of you.
You are, and I'm sorry that you had to go through that, John.
Okay, I thought Abby had seen it.
No, I had not.
Okay, yeah, I had zero interest, and I was kind of surprised you made yourself watch it.
Look,
kudos to you, I guess.
What I told Will offline was I would do anything for this podcast. The sacrifices I would make for Cinemaholics. No, okay. So what is this movie? Secret Society of Secondborn Royals. Going to be pretty brief on this one. I think it's a pretty easy one to sum up in what it is. So essentially, we have this new thing. It's called Disney Plus. Came out a year ago. And a little less than a year ago. But what one thing that I think Disney has seen an opportunity with Disney Plus in terms of their originals is to sort of take what has been successful about their Disney Channel original movies and maybe expand that to an even wider audience. So people who have Disney Plus, but you know, maybe they're just, you know, they're not on Disney Channel. It's not their thing for whatever reason. And to me, it's very clear that Secret Society of Secondborn Royals is sort of striking that balance. This is a Disney Channel original movie that's been maybe been given a little bit more of a budget, slightly. It's probably, you know, it has more in common with, say, like Magic Camp than Mandalorian. It's not big budget or anything. But they're clearly, you know, Disney, they have a list of things where they're like, all right, this is what's making us money. Princesses. Yeah. That's since the beginning, okay? Since 38, we've just been... The whole princess thing's been pretty good. What else we got? Okay, Star Wars. People love Star Wars. That's sci-fi, right? Okay, yeah, add sci-fi to the list. Superheroes? Yeah, Marvel. You know, highest grossing films of all time, sure. Okay, so like, what if we put them all together? That's what this is. This is literally just... They were like, here are all the things we want in this movie so that people will be like, yeah, I'll watch that. It has three things that I like. And I have no idea if that is a successful strategy. I have to say, the only reason I even know this thing exists is because I almost was going to review it for the school and I ended up not. But regardless, I was like, well, I'll watch it anyway. What is this? You know, maybe this is the Disney Channel original movie that's going to make me stop thinking the brand is forever associated with things like Descendants. Because when I was growing up, you know, so not to be an old man here, old in quotes, obviously. But, you know, I grew up on some pretty good Disney Channel original movies. I'm not going to lie. I like the ones like, Other Me and Brink and Smart House. Will, Abby, is any of this striking up your nostalgia? Either of you Disney Channel fans back in the day?
Oh, absolutely. Yes. Yeah. We got cable when I was in the sixth grade and Disney Channel was my favorite thing for like the next 3 years. Mm.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't grow up with cable, but I did see Smart House and what was it, Zoom or Zune?
Zoom. You talk about Xenon?
Xenon, yeah, that's right. Yeah, I saw that one.
I watched all three of those. I think there might be four at this point. Huh?
I think I've only saw the first two. But yeah, my familiarity with Disney Channel movies is loose, but I have seen a few of them.
Yeah, I even saw the Xenon where they went to the moon. That's when things got real crazy. Okay, so that said, yeah, we have nostalgia for this, and I think that since then, Disney Channel has gone off in a different direction because, you know, kids are different than how we are. And, you know, I went into this movie expecting that, right? I did not expect this was going to be something that was made for me. We've kind of talked about that already on this show with Enola Holmes. But this movie, I think I was like a C+ with Enola Holmes before I watched this. And then I was like, you know what? I've been spoiled. You know, I've been complaining about Netflix movies so much that I've forgotten how bad some of these movies can be. And this is an example of, I would absolutely rewatch this as part of a drinking game, as part of a so bad it's fun to watch kind of situation with a group of people, because it is pretty laughably bad. It is one of those movies. So what's the story here? Okay. We are in a kingdom that's called Illyria, and it's this sort of like, I guess, alternate reality where planet Earth is made up of all of these monarchy, like the monarchy never ended. It's like, what if, you know, the Victorian age had not brought about things like a permanent parliament or whatever, what have you. The idea is that there's like the sort of American Europe, because most characters have American accents and we don't have democracy. Screw that. We have...
So... This is the Fantastic Beast world, essentially.
It's some, you know, I don't want to lead listeners astray. I don't want them to think this has anything magical about, like, anything about it. As much as I dislike the Fantastic Beasts movies,
that just sounds
there's way more imagination in that world by comparison.
Sure. Yeah, I just remember that Fantastic Beasts was just like, what if America was Britain? And that's my main thing I remember. So that's why I remembered when you described it. But
sure. Yeah, it is just sort of like, you know, it's an interesting concept in theory, I guess. But I think what this movie presupposes is that we have a teenage high school that's primarily, if not totally, made up of royal born people. And in particular, there's a group of second born royals. So they're either the middle child or, you know, the youngest of two, which this movie never addresses, by the way, third borns, which I find pretty, as a fourth born, I feel very shafted by this movie. I'm very upset by that. But regardless, we have this sort of team where it's like a one part Avengers and the other part X-Men, because apparently if you are a second born royal, if and only if in this world, you have superpowers. Why? Stop asking questions. What do you want from this movie? A script? But that's the idea, is that yes, you are a second born royal, and these teenagers who are like 15, 16, they're told this unceremoniously. No, we don't have a moment where they discover the powers for themselves. That would make sense. No, they are in a room and somebody's like, yeah, around this age, you start having powers. And then they all figure out what their powers are. And it's like, okay, if I had the power to turn invisible, if I had the power like super senses and I could control insects and I could tell people what to do and they'll do anything I say, those are the powers here. I feel like I would figure that out pretty fast. But these characters even say that, like, oh yeah, I guess I did kind of notice something weird like a year ago and I'm like, I'm sorry, I should not be talking about this movie as if I should be entertaining it on any sort of analytical level. So I apologize.
I was going to say, it's a bummer that we already have X-Men, which showed us exactly how that would work in real life. And it would not be that easy.
It would have stakes.
Or Sky High, even.
Commentary. Which is a Disney film. Thank you, Will. Yes, Sky High. That is the movie that I was thinking about the entire time during this, because I was like, I want to watch Sky High instead. Now, there is a movie that is made for this sort of demographic that is the same kind of concept, like a superhero school, right? And that is a fun, entertaining, and mostly not stupid movie. I mean, there's a couple of things in it that are a little dumb, I guess, but like, I could watch Sky High today and have just as much of a blast with it as I did when I was 15.
It's cheesy, but it's like fun cheesy. It's like intentionally cheesy. Like, yeah. I would say, yeah.
And it has a decent twist for that age group. I think a lot of like kids growing up, like I know me, like I didn't see that coming, when who the villain is. And it's a fun movie and it's got a great cast. And so what is this doing here? Well, this secret society of second born royals. I think the messaging in this is just gross, where it's like your royal bloodline determines powers. I think the rules of this world make no sense, because, you know, the villain is a second born who murdered his brother. And sorry, that's not a twist. Everyone's going to figure that out in like the first, like as soon as he shows up. But like the idea is that like you're a second born, you're jealous because you don't get to rule the country. Why don't you get to be the king or queen? You have powers. Why is it a secret? Well, what is the gist of this world? It doesn't make sense.
How do you not just like instigate a coup the minute that you find out that you have supernatural powers that your sibling does not?
They're trying to say that like this society protects against that. I get they have to create a royal system of stopping other royals. It doesn't make sense.
I mean, they had to, otherwise you would have coups. They had to have something.
Yeah, it sounds like there's like no commentary here. It's just like, well, why do they do this? I don't know. It's cool.
Like, it's just cool.
Yeah, it's cool.
Well, they're trying to say something about like, don't be jealous of your older sibling who is not really better than you technically, right? Like that's kind of what they're getting at. It's like, you're special too, even if you're second best. In fact, you might even be more special than you. But yeah, they never get into like, for, you know, what if you're the youngest? What if you're the third or fourth born? Which I just found, again, I have to say, insulting. I know in our constellations, I think, Will, you would be a prince, right? Because you're the oldest in your family. You would be the king.
Oh, geez. Yeah. Good deal. Yeah. I don't know. That sounds pretty good to me. Yeah. That sounds pretty good to me.
You don't get powers. Abby, do you get powers in this world as a royal?
I do not. I am an only child. So no contestation to the throne there, though.
Yeah. So like if a family has no children, does that mean that like a third or fourth born would just like get like their powers essentially, like it would like reverberate, you know what I mean? Is that
if
the
they
case
have no or... children, what do you mean? Like if
so if there's like a family of like six,
okay,
and there's like a family of like no kids, like would they essentially get like what they're like, so like kid four would be in this case like a prince because like this family doesn't have I don't know.
I don't know. Well, I feel like you're trying to George R. R. Martin this thing, and yeah. I don't think sure, it's going to work out in your favor yeah. here. Yeah, the rules could not be more shallow. And, you know, even in regards to the movie, that is a pretty distracting thing. But they try to do things in here that are good for the kids. I'm not going to totally dump on this thing. Like, you have Peyton Elizabeth Lee, Niles Fitch, Isabella Blake Thomas. The most recognizable actor a lot of people will notice is probably Elodie Young, who we've seen in some pretty good movies. Also Gods of Egypt, but you know, I don't hate that movie. And also Skylar Astin from like Pitch Perfect. He's in this and you know, he's fun. He does kind of have a moment where he like shows up and he's like, all right, kids, I'm a superhero. Also, I'm gay. Let's train. And it's my favorite line delivery. Like he doesn't say it like that. He kind of says it like, my boyfriend's name is Harry. Like it's just very like, I don't know. It made me smile. But yeah, in terms of just the character relationships, and it's all very cheesy. It's camp rock. It's the thing that Disney's been doing for years. Kids are going to like that. Kids who like Descendants, which I've seen parts of because I have nieces. You know, I get it. I get what the appeal is. But yeah, I feel bad for people kind of stumbling across this maybe on Disney Plus who are like, what is this? A Disney Plus movie? Was this going to be in theaters? Oops, is what they're going to be saying eventually. But you know, it's harmless. You know, I don't think kids are going to walk away from it thinking that you know, taking away any messages, even though I do think the messages are kind of weird, I don't think that they're very persuasive. So I think there's that. So yeah, Secret Society of Second Born Royals, we will probably get a sequel to this before we get one of Enola Holmes, which is kind of a travesty. Grade wise, I think it's a C-. But all right, that'll do it for our show. Thank you for bearing with me on that's very difficult, that royal pain of a review for next week. Oh, there it is. Yeah, I snuck it in. Okay, so next week, what are we looking at? We have a new Netflix film coming out called The Boys in the Band. This one stars Jim Parsons, Zachary Quinto, and Matt Bomer. Crazy good cast. I don't know too much about this one, but that one comes out on, I think, Wednesday on the 30th. And then also The Glorias, which is a Sundance film that I saw. I was not a fan of The Glorias. It's a biopic, but kind of an unconventional biopic, similar in some ways to how Rocket Man was trying to break some traditional biopic rules. The Glorias is as well. I appreciate the effort, but yeah, I don't know if we'll have time to talk about that one next week. We'll see. But yeah, it's telling the story of Gloria Steinem, very inspiring, influential person. But yeah, that's a new indie release. And then there's Spontaneous. Abby, you know more about this one because you saw the trailer, but this is like a new Paramount thing with Katherine Langford and Charlie Plummer. What's the deal with this?
Yeah, from what I can tell from the trailer, it's about high school students, and Katherine Langford and Charlie Plummer are starting a relationship. They're very cute. And around the time that their relationship takes off, their classmates start to spontaneously explode. Which right, yeah. I think leads to some form of lockdown. So yeah, it's sort of, I guess, appropriate for teenagers who may be frustrated that they can't hang out with their boyfriend and or girlfriend during quarantine.
Right. Or else they will explode. That's just what high school is like. But all right. And then also On the Rocks, which this one's going to be in theaters. This is a new A24 film that'll eventually get to Apple TV Plus. And I could see this one being our featured review if it's not Spontaneous. This one is the newest Sofia Coppola film. It stars Rashida Jones, Bill Murray, Marlon Wayans. And I don't know if it's going to be good. I haven't heard anything about it until today, but it's supposed to be a dramedy. And judging by the pedigree, I could see this one being a worthwhile featured review for us. If we can see it, we'll see if that is the case. And then a couple other smaller things. I think Saban Films has a new indie film called Death of Me. And then there's something called The Call coming out, which I don't really know much about. But I think Tobin Bell is in that. But other than that, I think that's about everything we're getting. New York Film Festival is still going on. But
sorry, we need to talk about Dick Johnson is Dead because that's a
Oh, I forgot about that one.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, I thought that was also coming out. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, yes. That's another Sundance one. Yeah. What do we know about Dick Johnson is Dead? I think, have you seen that one already, Abby?
I have. I think a lot of folks, if you're a follower of film Twitter. There's a lot of love for Kirsten Johnson among that group, and a lot of folks who have been giving this very high marks, and I think with good reason. It's I saw it at the True False Film Festival earlier this year, like right before COVID started, I'm very glad that it's one of the final things that I got to see in a theatrical setting, because it's really good.
Nice. Yeah, I've heard nothing but good things. It was definitely a Sundance favorite. I was sad I missed it, but what about you, Will? Was there anything I missed, or did you have something to say about Dick Johnson?
No, I mean, I just wanted to make sure you didn't forget it. Yeah, I know that one's getting a lot of love, and I'm excited to see it for sure. So that's probably the one I'm most looking forward to. But I don't know if that's feature review, because it's a documentary. We've kind of had a mixed relationship as far as like documentaries as a feature review, but that's certainly the one I'm looking forward to the most of the ones you mentioned.
All right, well, those are plenty of films. We'll see. We'll let you all know what we're covering when we know. But for now, thank you as always for listening. Don't forget to check out our social pages and everything like that in the show notes, along with how you can send voicemails, email us, go on our website, read some reviews, have a good time, have a few laughs, whatever you want to do. We just appreciate that you are a listener of the show. All right, from the Internet California, I am John Agroni.
From the Internet Pennsylvania, I'm Will Ashton.
From the Internet Kansas City, I'm Abby Olchesi.
See you next time.